to Build, Lead, Thrive, Voices of Andras Goggin, a bi-monthly podcast that features in-depth conversations with the people shaping Andras Goggin County. Each episode dives into personal stories, showcasing the leaders and entrepreneurs behind the region's economic and community vitality. I'm your host, Shanna Cox, President and CEO of the LA Metro Chamber. I'm joined by local talent, longtime friend, and our producer, Mark Turcotte.
Hello.
Welcome back, sir.
Thank you.
Together, we explore how incredible people, the voices of Andras Goggin, build, lead, and thrive while contributing to a better quality of life for all. I'm excited for today. We have Ken Albert with us. And so Ken is someone I met pretty quickly upon arriving at the chamber and struck me almost immediately as somebody who I think took the time to see me for who I was and not just make assumptions about who I might be based on my role.
That's nice.
Well, as the person who gets assumed a lot, thank you. It's very nice on my end too. So let me tell you just a little bit about Ken. He's currently the president and chief executive officer for Andwell Health Partners. You might have known them as Andras Goggin Home Health Care and Hospice. Prior to his appointment in June of 2016, which is almost a decade ago now.
I know.
I don't know how that happens. Ken served as the director and chief operating officer of the Maine Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Way to get out before 2020, Ken.
Amen.
He was the director of the Division of Licensing and Regulatory Services within the Maine Department of Health and Human Services. Before joining the department in March of 2012, he practiced law for several years in Maine, specializing in health law, professional licensing, and regulatory compliance law. So just wait till we hit in the
Doesn't
next.
Doesn't that sound exciting?
Yeah, well, we're not even there yet, folks. His background's rich in medical experience because he had 17 years as a registered nurse. So if you're curious, it's almost like a joke. Name a nurse, a lawyer, and a healthcare administrator. I'll walk into a bar, and it's just Ken Albert. So he spent some time as the director of emergency services at CMMC, the administrator of the Affiliated Occupational Health Center, and is the site manager for Life Flight of Maine. For folks who don't know, those are the helicopters that help connect our rural folks in need of healthcare to some of our kind of big healthcare centers.
Trauma centers, yep.
Yeah, it's I live in the Life Flight's path, so very familiar with their services
you,
and their frequency.
You know the sound of the world.
My home is right between St. Mary's and CM. So I not only get the Life Flight, but any kind of ambulances going in either direction. It's a fun and exciting place to live. You spent 5 years as a traveling critical care nurse, and in that time you worked in metropolitan, rural, and tribal communities. Mm-hmm. Outside of Maine?
Outside of Maine, yes. I worked Arizona, California. Tribal communities was in Montana and in Arizona, working with the Yuman Indians in Arizona. Very,
really?
Very different
yeah.
culture for healthcare.
So my boys are part Cherokee and have had some time to go to Oklahoma, which is where a lot of their family now resides, and ended up after the Trail of Tears. They don't normally, that's not where they originated. But there's a lot of differences in our indigenous populations across. So that's really cool. So Southwest.
Yes.
Yeah, that's amazing. You served for several years as an adjunct faculty member at New England College, where you taught legal issues and healthcare administration. So you're also a teacher. And then on top of all that, like, you're not doing enough in your career, doing enough locally. And I think this is the stuff that people who, because you're pretty well known locally. You have a presence. You've had a presence for a while, as we just discussed. I don't think people know the extent of your reach, your impact, your leadership at a national level. Some of this I knew, but ready for this. Ken was elected to the National Association for Home Care and Hospice in 2019, again in 2021, where he served as chairman for 3 years. And then following a merger with the National Hospice and Palliative Care Organization, he now serves as officially chairman of the board for the combined entity, which is called the National Alliance for Care at Home, which is the largest healthcare trade association in the U.S. Just on the side, just a little like your regular work day is not enough. You just pepper in a little bit of that.
Yeah, it's like a part-time job.
Yeah. I mean, I know what I ask of my board. Like, it probably is a part-time job.
Yeah, the merger alone was a challenge. You had two very, very different cultures, similar missions, but very different cultures. So to bring those two organizations together was Yeah, it was a very worthy responsibility, I think, in order to unify the voice of the care at home industry on the Hill, being able to walk in and sit down with a member of Congress and have a conversation, not have them ask us, well, what about this other organization? Yeah. What's their perspective? We have one unified voice now for healthcare at home.
That's really impactful. And we're going to get into this later, so don't give away too much right now. But maybe never a more important time to be talking about policy and healthcare. I've seen that impact in my own life. So in addition to your service at the national level, just because you're not busy enough, you served on the Board of Trustees for the Maine College of Health since 2016, 4 years as chairman. Are you still currently doing that?
I'm on the board, but my good friend, Dr. Ned Claxton, stepped in as chairman of the board because I was getting so busy at the national level.
Bless his heart.
I recruited him to the board, and then within a matter of a couple of months, have I got a deal for you?
Yeah.
And so that worked out really well. He's fantastic.
Yeah, no, he is incredible. You'd have to. So that's all of you in your professional sense, but some of the things that I connected with you on as just a human, you live in Lewiston, which is where I reside, and clearly you could have chosen anywhere, and we'll talk about this a little bit, but Andwell now is you cover a whole state. So you have two adult children who moved away but came home, which I love. And in your free time, and this is where Ken and I usually spend a lot of our time talking, he works on his perennial gardens. And I feel like the perennial garden sells you short because you invest significant time in peppering in annuals in your garden every year.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's where I cut a corner.
It's therapeutic. It's therapeutic, right?
I get 2 12 packs of petunias, tuck them in around my perennials, and say, look what I've done.
No, I think it's art. I think gardening with flowers. I did a lot of vegetables, and when my kids were younger and wanted to show them how to grow their food. But being able to kind of express yourself through the art of gardening, and using color and just creating
and texture and seasonality, because it's not for me, and I know this is true for you, but it's not enough for my garden to look good in the spring.
No,
or look, the garden's in its happy 3 weeks in July. I think a really well, and this for me is the practice of it. This is the art of it, right? This is the constant learning and growth. But I aim for my garden to speak to you from the crocuses in the spring to the way that I don't deadhead the last pieces that give structure and texture in the winter against the snow. Yeah. I want my garden to sing year round to me. And it's funny because I grew up not really vegetable gardening, not really, I left home at 15. And so for me to lay down actual roots, in the dirt was a pretty big thing. Mm. And I did that in some very temporary places, still just saying this is my space, and I'm claiming a little bit on it. And so I've always felt that way about plants and what it does. Mm. And there's now, I think, 4 perennial gardens around the tree streets in the Lewiston area that I still go visit. That was my this is home, and this is what even if it's a home that's not my forever home. And so now that I am in my forever home, the ability to say, well, that reaches maturity in 10 years and it'll be 15 feet tall and I need to plan for that. And knowing that I'm not going to see it get to that point for another 10, 12 years, but I love gardens.
It doesn't matter the space you're in, whether it's temporary or permanent.
Right.
The leaving a place and a space better than where you found it.
I love that.
Yeah.
So we're bringing back, by wild popular request from our thousands and thousands of listeners.
I want to know who exactly. I want to see this email or text.
Shout out to Mo.
Okay.
I don't think Mo was the only one, but we're going to bring back a little ditty as we introduce our new segment. So, Ken, we both apologize and want to prepare.
Should I turn around so I don't make
No, actually, you can feel free to join in.
I am not joining. I will.
After you hear us, you might want to.
Okay.
We'll just 2 bars. We'll keep it really short.
Okay.
You ready?
Yes.
Getting to know you. Getting to know all. You're welcome. That's the intro to the segment.
I get where you're going with it.
I mean, thank you. In an early segment, we wanted to introduce some music, and being not really musical of any sort, either of us, that's the best we could do. We cut it out of a couple of episodes, and
due to complaints,
very loud feedback by Mo and dozens others that we should bring back the singing. Anyway, Mark,
Those people need professional help.
We are their professional help.
Yes.
That's what they need from us.
Our first segment is called Getting to Know You, where we ask guests fun, personality-revealing questions to help you learn about and connect with our guests on a personal level. Before we get into the deeper questions, this is like the appetizers before the main course.
So a couple of little short questions. You ready? What is your go-to productivity hack when you're feeling overwhelmed? Like doing a brand release expansion and a national merger, for example. Just to give a little context and time for you.
So I have tried all the digital tools. I've tried, to organize my task. And I've gone back to paper.
Yeah.
And but I organize, and it's something I print off myself, I've created myself. It literally has my to-do list for every person that reports to me, that I work with, all the different projects that I have going on, and I do it I do one for every week. And then I just check those boxes. There's something
so nice about checking the
boxes. And moving something along, moving a project along, and making sure you're not missing something or somebody, even worse. You know that I was on a flight on Monday and did it on the plane for getting ready for my week this week. And it was just, I felt organized. Mm-hmm. And for me, breaking that list up into not just a list of tasks, but what's the project? What are the tasks I need to do this week? Who am I meeting with? What do we need to accomplish in that meeting? For my own board of directors, I have a couple things every week that I have to navigate there. So I break it out in segments, and it just makes it more consumable, achievable.
No, I can appreciate that. So do you check off a box, or do you slash a line through it?
No, it's a box.
Yeah.
Come on.
Said definitively.
Like, why do it?
Nice and clean.
You
got to
put a check mark in there.
Not an X. Full check mark.
Yeah.
There's a release that comes with that.
There is.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. What is a book, podcast, show, or movie that has inspired you recently?
Yeah, that's a really, really interesting question. There's so much. I mean, I love, like, Netflix, and there's a lot of good stuff out there. But I got to tell you, a book that just I read about a year ago or so, it just continues to stick with me, is American Dirt. And I'm sorry I cannot recall the author of the book, but it is riveting from the very first page until the very end, and it describes the journey of Mexican immigrants into the United States and where and the challenges. It follows it was a journalist and his wife in Mexico and their child. And not all journalism, not all countries enjoy free speech.
Yeah.
And journalistic liberty currently. and so they had to make their way into America, and what they have to go through as just human beings to make it across that border to a land that they believe is going to yield freedom.
Yeah, an opportunity.
Safety, an opportunity, exactly.
That's incredible.
But really good story. Really, like,
good writing.
Yeah, really great writing.
There's a couple of books in my life that have, like, I come back to just themes, or I don't know, sometimes the themes come back to me. Like, there's a piece of my life that's like, oh, there's a reason you're thinking about that again. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'll reread kind of over and over some of those. So, American Dirt.
Worth the read.
That sounds great. Paper or Kindle?
Oh, paper.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if you want to pass along that for a borrow, I would.
Yeah.
That's the problem with Kindle people. You can't just borrow the books when they're done. What is one local business or community initiative that excites you right now?
I've got to tell you, I think that the relationship with Central Maine Healthcare and Prime Health Foundation is, I think it's, I am super excited about that. I actually wrote a letter in support of that this weekend. And you know, when I'm sitting at the keyboard, normally I know what I got to write and my fingers start flying. But I really paused to give this one some thought because I think it's so important. Mm-hmm. It's so important for Central Maine, so important for our Lewiston and Auburn community that this work well. And I think it is an example of my belief that hospitals in Maine in isolation are not, because of the rural nature of where we are not going to be able to invest in the infrastructure, the workforce, the technology, the science that we need.
And deserve.
They deserve. I was just going to say that main
and
people deserve.
Right.
And so kudos to Steve Littleton and his team over there for over many years, right?
Yeah.
He's not the only CEO that's been looking at this for us, that have found a partner who's a nonprofit, allows local control, is willing to invest in the community,
and
which
has
means
significant capital to actually do it.
That's right.
Because that piece, like, even if you got those other pieces, all those magical stars to align in the sky, oftentimes there isn't, because so many healthcare systems everywhere are strapped. Like, having resources to invest is not, it's an integral piece of the whole thing working together.
We need outside investment. We need outside capital being invested. And I think that's important, why I'm excited about it, because I believe that healthcare in a community is vital to a thriving, not just surviving, but a thriving community where anybody can see themselves. Young families can see themselves, and elders, you know, our aging population can continue to see themselves staying and be active and healthy in the community. We need quality healthcare. Access to quality healthcare for, I think it's essential for a thriving community. So I'm excited about this.
No, I love that you picked that one. I'm a big fan. I was really fortunate to have some great conversations with Steve before it went public, and be able to hear kind of all of the steps he explored before ultimately, you know, choosing this one and choosing it really with the intention of local control, of investment. It was really thoughtful, and I'm super excited. I think it could be... That is just an incredible amount of investment. I don't think people can really wrap their heads around. It's like $150 million over 5 or 10 years.
Right, over 5 years. I think that, you know, $150 million is, when I look at healthcare and the cost of healthcare and technology, it sounds like a big number, right? It is a big number.
Yeah.
And we need more.
We could probably drop 500.
We need more innovation. We could drop 500, exactly. But one step at a time, and this is a great step for our community. Yeah. So.
Oh, I love that you picked that one. It is a really exciting one, and I'm looking forward to it. All right, so we might have covered this already. I'm curious to see, but what's your favorite way to spend time in Androscoggin County?
First off, I love to go out and try out some, you know, always give new restaurants a try, right? I think that's, I love to see that. I love Thorncraig. I love going there. I think that's a gem in our community here. That we have, whether it's winter, I don't know. We're getting into the mud season. I'm not sure. The winter's great.
Do you snowshoe, or are you able to do it?
You can get up in. You can get up in there. You just gotta have some good boots. We're getting into the, you know, the mud season. You may not want to try it then, but but it's a gem. I'd say that's.
Those are good ones.
Yeah.
Those are good ones. All right, some meat and potatoes. I have a couple of questions for you.
Okay.
Ready? And these are like I put some thought into. Your experience, your leadership, your intellect, frankly, is so deep and so broad, and you don't usually get both of those when you're talking to somebody.
We haven't finished this podcast yet. I hope you have the same opinion when we finish the conversation.
But it's like there was so many, I mean, we only, you know, spend like a little bit more than an hour together. There were so many different directions I could go in. So bear with me, and if there's something it feels like you really wanted to speak about that I missed, there's room for that. Okay. But we're going to start with the evolution of home health care, because I think that is a thing I've heard you speak to before. And it's not evolution like we're done, right? Like, there is a current evolution underway. And so your careers spanned emergency medicine, regulatory services, and now home health care leadership. What are shifts that you've seen in the home health care and hospice industry over the last decade, and how or what is Anduril Health Partners doing in terms of positioning itself for the future? You've made some really big, impressive, valuable moves in this. And I think you've been spotting the trends and paying attention to the trends, in some places getting ahead of or leading. And so talk to me about that.
When you think about the cost of healthcare, you think about the continuum of healthcare is you have primary care, you have acute care, which is care in the hospitals. So we go see our doctors, you know, routinely, hopefully. Then if we get sick, we need to go into the hospital. And hospitals need a place to discharge the patients to, a safe discharge.
Yeah.
And frequently, about 60 to 70% of those discharges from the hospital will find their way into a post-acute, and I'm going to say, you know, home health environment, whether that's kids or adults.
Where does a traditional kind of rehabilitation facility fall into that post-acute care?
So skilled nursing facilities, yeah, or what we refer to as SNFs,
really?
Are SNFs. That's what they call them, SNFs.
Do you enjoy that?
No.
Does it still make you snicker?
No. No, I've said it like 2 million times in my career, so.
So it's lost the edge for you.
It's lost.
I might snicker again, no guarantees.
I'll just say skilled nursing facilities.
No, say SNF, I love it.
So they're part of the post-acute continuum as well. Mm. What I just described for you is the continuum of care. And what we've seen over, you know, definitely the last decade, although health policy has been driving at this for probably 15 years now through federal laws and regulations, is we used to be very siloed. So primary care didn't speak with hospitals. Hospitals didn't speak with home health. And now with laws like the Impact Act and other federal regulatory schemes, we are compelled to, A, share information electronically across our health records, so that, which is, as a consumer of healthcare, makes me happy because I want my hospital, the doctor who is in the hospital, to be communicating well with my primary care docs and my specialists, right? So in addition to that sharing of information requirements, what we're seeing now is that the reimbursement for primary care, for home health, and for the hospitals are linked.
Oh.
And they're linking more. So when the hospital discharges a patient to home health, if that patient, let's say, gets readmitted back to the hospital within 30 days, the hospital does not get reimbursed for that second admission to the same level that they would have had it been initially.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't get reimbursed. I because the cost...
As a consumer of healthcare, I feel like this is incentivizing better care for me.
Yes. But why would you say that?
Because if there is an incentive for the person who is discharging me to make sure I do not show back up in their hospital, that's great. In a prior environment, and I feel like I lived this, particularly, like I said, I left home at 15. I had a broken foot when I was 16 and a half, and I was technically my own legal guardian. I didn't have real health insurance. And so, I mean, I was discharged with I bet that's sore. You should learn to walk on it. Mm. No x-ray, no real diagnostic. It took 3 more visits, 2 months of lost work, and me paying out of pocket a podiatrist to show me where the x-ray had been on the second visit, where the break was, where the 2 stress fractures that compounded from the original one was now. Mm. And that experience was a reminder that everywhere on that continuum that I experienced was zero incentive for me to get better, because each time was a cash visit and more pay. There was an incentive for them to see me again, not the other way around.
Correct.
Tell me I'm wrong, right?
You're absolutely right. And so payers, including our governmental payers, Medicare and Medicaid, mm-hmm. and other third party,
also got tired of that.
That's great. Too. And they're saying, hey, we want to pay you for value, not volume.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't want to pay you for the more you do, the more you get paid. That's a kind of perverse incentive, right? But as a consumer of healthcare, if the better I do, the more my healthcare providers get paid. That's a win-win for everybody involved in that, because obviously the patient is a very significant component of that healthcare delivery.
Yay!
Right? Right?
You always do such a good job breaking it down. I mean, so yes, I would say it should be, but I would say there are a couple of really life-altering path went this way moments in my own life that I didn't feel as the patient that my healthcare really was speaking or seeing me as that wasn't the goal. From the conversations with my actual providers to the discussions with the insurance company or the actual invoicing provider, for years it actually didn't feel like the patient was the focal point.
And we're not there yet. Trust me.
No, yeah, there
not
is.
Not there yet.
Yeah.
To say that the American healthcare system is broken is an understatement.
Yeah.
And I think I was actually spent the last 2 days in Washington, D.C., and talking about these very issues. And I think that we are experiencing profound disruptive innovation.
Mm-hmm.
I think that term sometimes is overused. But we are, you heard me talk about this summer with the chamber, like there's just, the money is not there. The tax base to be able to pay for healthcare is going away. Yeah. And so,
the costs continue to go up. Like there's a disparity,
The costs go up. So we the entire healthcare system is undergoing radical transformation.
Yeah. What's that going to look like for me as a patient? And, you know, just for math and fun, I'll be 45 this summer. I hope that my home care and palliative care needs are decades away, and my kids promise they're going to make sure I have good services. It's a regular conversation at our dinner table. It's like a clear commitment of nice care as I age, which they've insisted will come best from professionals and not from them, in case you're curious about how they weigh in on the conversation. So, you know, I'll see you and your crew in a couple decades. Yeah, they plan on that in a very hands-off, physically kind of way. But, like, I sometimes get excited about the promise of what could be. I have friends who live in different countries where their healthcare, while not perfect, is light years away from leaving you homeless or bankrupt or uncared for, right? And so I get really excited, like, yes, give me disruptive innovation, and where's that going to take me, and what will be my patient experience? Do you have a crystal ball, Ken? Can you predict all of that for me?
Yeah, I worry right now. Like I said, you know, spending the last 48 hours in D.C. and watching what's going on there, watching what's going on with in our own state legislature right now. And, you know, today's the first day without a supplemental budget where the caps on Medicaid payments and, you know, hospitals are only being paid effective today at 70% of what they were paid for before under Medicaid, right? Large providers are not going to be receiving their payments this week because we don't have a supplemental budget passed. We have Congress who is hell-bent on cutting $880 billion over the next 10 years.
It's going to be
so huge. So I will not ascribe the term disruptive innovation to those initiatives yet because I'm not convinced all disruption is innovative.
Yeah, same.
And so we'll see what happens. But we cannot keep spending at the rate that we're spending. Yeah. And expecting that our taxes, our wallets, our own individual personal wallets are not going to be impacted by that. Yeah. We have to figure this out, and you know it's going to be painful, but I like to think that we will.
Yeah. Okay. I'll take that crystal ball version. Okay. Thanks. Yeah. It's incredible. So when we look at those kind of trends, you've led at the intersection of healthcare and law and policy, which a lot of people work in one of those three. Maybe they'll dabble in two, but your work really has pulled all three of those together. And you've done that at the state level with the CDC and then nationally, now with the National Alliance for Care at Home. Is that what brought you to DC?
It is.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So from your perspective, how have state level healthcare decisions in Maine influenced national trends and vice versa? I mean, you just gave a little bit of synopsis, a very snapshot, very current moment in time. But how have those kind of two policy environments been influencing? Is Dear or Go Real? Do we lead? Is it the other way?
Yeah. I think we're fortunate and unfortunate in some levels. So I think the way that Maine is going to influence federal policy is ensuring that we have the right voices to raise their hand for rural America.
Mm.
It is, as we look at population density, which is occurring at a significant rate across this country, so you're seeing rural communities decline, and you're seeing metropolitan areas increase in population. When that occurs, you're going to see the money follow the human.
Yeah.
And so you're going to see the money being drained out of rural areas, particularly as in healthcare investment, into those more urban metropolitan areas. We have to ensure states like Maine, with people, there are other folks like me who are down there ensuring that our rural voices are being heard and not left out of policy.
Yeah.
I will tell you that I am convinced more than ever. I used to believe that policy and politics, while there was an intersection, were two
That Venn distinctly diagram is really different.
The Venn diagram is there's
those circles
no,
are just coming. It's just like one a lunar big eclipse. Circle. They're just coming. Yeah, they're coming together.
I you know when it comes to healthcare policy, I do not believe we'll be successful if we don't approach it from a political perspective every single time.
Yeah. Whatever time frame we had to just focus on policy, and I have lots of friends in policy work, and they've come to the real and policy because they. And I think this is true. Someday I hope to run for a public office, be in public service. And part of the reason I believe, like I feel a calling for that and I see something of an opportunity there is because when you are a politician, you are able to influence policy, and policy level change has deeper, broader, more impact, right? Like you can just change. I had this really great opportunity to work on lead poisoning prevention policy. And while it felt like a very small piece of like the time and hours that I spent in that job, the impact is still being felt by 5-year-olds and under in the Lewiston Auburn area as we decrease the rates of lead poisoning, which a decade from now, you'll start to see the results of less criminal justice interaction and better academic outcomes. And so like, as you can tell, policy gets me excited because the scale for impact. But I know some folks were like, oh, yuck, I don't want any part of the politics, but see that same opportunity in policy and focus in policy. And, you know, they're also starting to see less and less opportunity to be policy focused without having to get involved in politics. There's less division of that.
So you talk about the Venn diagram. Yeah. When I was appointed to the Maine CDC, in that appointment, I became what's called the state health official, or they call them the SHOs. And there's one state health official for every state in the country. And we're all appointed at various times. And so in my cohort, there was 11 other appointees across the country at the same time. State health officials are the state's liaison to the federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and also to Washington, D.C., with regard to health policy initiatives in public health. And so we spent some time down in Atlanta, the CDC there being trained together. Dr. Nirav Shah was actually in my cohort of 11.
Juicy, he's coming back to me.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah.
It's going to be nice to have him back. And then... after we leave Atlanta, we go to the Kennedy School of Policy at Harvard, and we are immersed for 2 weeks. They do great work, but we're all immersed there around the notion of advancing health policy and public health within our jurisdictions. That Venn diagram was very separate at the time, so they clearly you understood that policy you need to. The coalition, the political coalition, to be able to drive policy, but even that was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Those two are just as we just described, just
overlapping. Yeah,
I think we have to actually consider the politics first before. I mean, we have to know what we want to drive for policy, understand the politics really clearly in order to be able to achieve that policy.
No, I think that's right. I'm concerned about the impact of reductions of birth and OBGYN care in rural Maine. And it has, this is where, there's so much economic impact. When you look at Machias losing its birthing facilities, and now Blue Hill is also seeing some of that. When you see that reduction, it is a huge sign that says, do not come here if you're young. Do not come here if you have not yet had your children. Do not come here if you are thinking about having another child. Please and thank you. And if you are of those ages, if you were born here and love here, we talk about brain drain. If you're born here and you love it here, you better go somewhere else and have a family and then still come back, hopefully, a decade later when those early stage care is, prenatal and early stage care is gone. And I think there's like 8 birthing centers in Maine now. And from an economic perspective, like we talk about being the oldest state in the nation, and everything about that says, and that's cool. We're good with that. We don't want to have a younger population or a birthing age population. And it's just really, really profound for the, I'm in all of these spaces that are talking about workforce and our workforce gap and our projected cliff and the succession of business owners. And like we have those conversations and it feels like such a separate conversation than healthcare and birthing needs. But It is not. It shouldn't be a separate conversation from my perspective. And so much of that is rural.
Well, as I said
sorry
to you earlier,
soapbox.
No. Hey, let me help you firm up that soapbox.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I said earlier, healthcare is vitally important for a healthy and thriving community.
Thank you.
And a healthy and thriving community needs young families. It needs, you know, regardless of your age or stage in life, you need to be able to see yourself living in that community.
Yeah.
Part of seeing yourself there is knowing that there are the services and resources that you need in order to be successful.
Yeah.
And when OBGYN services, birthing centers, are disappearing, and it's not just here in Maine.
It's national.
All across
oh, it's 100%
the
national.
And we're not alone. But
that doesn't make me feel better.
So we need to ensure
yeah.
that rural policy,
exactly.
whether we're talking energy policy or whether we're talking mm-hmm. healthcare, whether we're talking, you know, it doesn't matter what the policy
data
is.
Data and internet?
We have to ensure that
also
voice
economic
is
issue.
At the table.
Yeah.
In Washington.
I think you're absolutely right. It's funny, I didn't know that was the direction your answer was going to go in, but it's exactly, I think, the representation of rural communities. And I mean, we talk about, you know, Maine being the biggest small town you've ever lived in, but like, we're all rural in Maine. We're recording this in Maine's second largest city, which numbers roughly 38,000.
Mm-hmm.
If you combined us with Auburn, we'd be close to Portland size, which is only 65,000, 68,000. Like the whole state is, you know, we love to sit here and pontificate about being in a metropolitan area and being a city, and we are, Deb, we are, says the Lewis and Auburn Metropolitan Chamber of Commerce President and CEO, right? But man, the whole state is rural.
And some would say, listen, if you choose to live there, that's your choice, and you get what you get with that choice. And I disagree with that entirely.
Thank you.
I think that we can choose to live in rural, not only rural, but even frontier areas. Maine has some frontier
yeah.
areas, as does as do other states. You know, and when we're talking frontier, that gets a little bit more gray
yeah.
for me. But rural, you should. I once worked with a really interesting lady who, I won't mention her name, but from a health policy perspective, she was phenomenal. And she said to me one day, she worked for me at the state, and she said, "Ken, we can't have a chicken in every pot."
Mm.
And I said, "I get that. I understand that. But when we have an 80-year-old husband having to drive 4.5 hours to see his wife in a long-term care facility, we need to be cultivating more chickens."
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. Well, even that argument assumes that one chose there, and not that they're the eighth generation raised there, that family has their ancestors buried on it, that their farm has been there for forever, or that was the second house built in the town that's named after that family, and that moving is both an economically accessible choice, but a preferred choice.
Right.
And the assumption of that argument has always just grated against me, because I know so many people who either do not have the choice, the freedom of choice for economic means, because they're caring for somebody who, what, their grandfather lived there and their father lived there and they're never going to move, and they came home to care for that family member, right? It's like some people just don't have the choice. And we are not, statewide, we are not in a position to not incentivize people choosing to be here as well.
Preach it.
Thanks. Good chat. That's it. Mic drop. We're done. Cut. We were headed into this direction, and so I'm just going to forge ahead. Healthcare isn't just about patient care. It is a major economic driver, specifically for job creation, quality of life. So this is me making you push another crystal ball moment, if you will. How do you see the healthcare sector shaping our local economy regionally? And what investments or innovations do you think are most critical for sustaining that impact or even creating it? Yeah, I mean, you've named a couple of these pieces already, but what have you not said about the innovations that are needed and the economic impact? Because you can't blame me for asking about economy. To a guy who's in healthcare, you've got to forgive me that, right?
No, I think that I think, boy, that's a tougher one, Shana, because I think that the salaries that healthcare draws for people, right? I mean, you've got to be able to compensate people for their skill set, for sure. But on the flip side of that, when you look at the reinvestment of those incomes and those salaries back into the community, it is the circle of life.
Sing it,
the
sir.
Circle of life, as we say, of the life of a dollar and the life of our economy. I think so. When I think about the direction that St. Mary's is taking and really investing in the behavioral health arena, when I think about Prime Health, as we mentioned earlier, it's those types of strategic initiatives are not just addressing what we have here and now for our economy, but they're looking out 10, 15, 20 years. Very thoughtfully and strategically planning for what our community is going to need, which will hopefully drive the economy at the end of the day.
Yes, and, right? Because it's not a but, it's an additional, so like, those are big pictures. I tend to think in big pictures, big visions and systems, and I've always enjoyed the fact that you and I can talk in systems. Not everybody prefers that kind of level of conversation, but here's one. Where I'm going to take it down from systems to on the ground, and this is why I'm really hung up on the fact in your bio I get to say that you live in Lewiston. Some of the best salaries that are paid by employers in this region, right, are at our healthcare systems, and I am a big believer that we need to compete with Boston, we need to compete with New York to pull really fantastic healthcare professionals, surgeons, all of the talent. So 100% there. I really want them to live here. In terms of local economic impact, not only would it be transformative, but the departure of so many healthcare and frankly educational professionals from some local colleges too, choosing to not live here anymore, has had such an economic impact.
Oh, but you said choosing to not live here.
Yeah.
I don't know that I agree with you there.
Good, let's argue it.
All right. I think for some it's a choice, right? You're choosing to, you know, live in Falmouth or Yarmouth you know. But we're also seeing that stretch a little bit more north now. You're seeing Turner and Green and, you know, those communities, which, hey, let's
I'd love them to live
here. Right, right.
I would pick that.
We have a housing stock issue.
Yeah.
In this community.
Yeah.
And so having the neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And having, it's because community, you know, economic development.
I want you to say this. I just
economic
want to be clear.
Development and community development
yes.
are not mutually exclusive.
No, nor are they inseparable.
Right.
Yes.
So if you want people who have that level of income to live in the communities in which they work, so to live and play in the communities in which they work,
spend their money, invest in our school system.
You have to have the housing stock.
Yeah.
You have to have the educational systems that are going to educate their kids.
Yeah. So in summary, good quality and a variety of options of housing stock and good quality accessible education systems are part of what providing choice looks like so that one could choose to live here.
I would add one more thing, because I also say play, right? Mm-hmm. So we need good trails. We need good entertainment. We need good restaurants. We need good museums. We need arts and entertainment, right? It is
checking those off. We're doing a bunch of that. That's underway.
So we're doing that, right? We have, and I'm super looking forward to our new city administrator to see what is going to happen there, right?
Yeah.
What new energy that he's going to bring to bear in this community. So I think we should all be excited about that and look to support him as he lands here. So.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. So I loved everything that you just said. That's not pushing back. That's 100% in a... Well, because I think it's really important. I think there is I think that we are getting to a place where there is more shared thinking, more agreement and recognition that housing inventory by amount and variety and location, the options there matter in our economic drivers. It feels so, I'm grateful that you said it, because I think it's much more, of course I say that. Like, it's my job to say that. Of course I say that. But to hear somebody in healthcare with your experience, with the network that you have, say the same thing, I think it's a really valuable thing. And I've had this conversation, like, bold of you to say it, thanks for doing it, knowing that it's going to be recorded and shared, because I've had this conversation offline with professors and administrators at colleges and universities. I've had this conversation with folks deeply in healthcare, both, you know, the high six-figure earners and talent, as well as the administrators that work with them. And they lament that it does not exist, but feel like it is not an issue that, like, is worth bringing up, or that it's their place to bring. Who am I? I live in Falmouth. Who am I to criticize that? Who am I to say I would have if, right? And so, you know, folks who are in economic development, business development, folks who are starting businesses, folks who are in city administrations and municipal administrations, make a lot of assumptions that those people just didn't even look at us, or it's just our image, and not really understanding that there are, like, tangible things that we could do as economic development Absolutely. Strategies that would attract and retain those individuals that have the disposable income to invest in this community.
And make it really easy.
Yeah.
And from a regulatory standpoint for real estate investment mm-hmm, to occur here mm-hmm. and in construction as well. I mean, we need it both from a commercial yeah. as well as individual personal housing. So
I will give you some good news on that, and our listeners
Please do.
Too. That is underway. And in my own trend watching, I started digging into housing as it related to health impacts and community health impacts. That was maybe my first foray into Lewiston and Auburn, was focused on that issue, specifically around lead poisoning. And at the time, rental housing was associated with poverty. Only people who were poor and could not yet afford their dream single-family house lived in renting. And because that was the mindset, the only rentals that were available served that need. There was nothing else. You either had multifamilies that were very distressed or single-family homes in little tiny subdivisions.
It's changing.
So I advocated for change. I advocated for luxury and high-end rentals, because sometimes I had the good fortune to rent to a resident at one of the local healthcare hospitals who only was ever going to be here for 3 years. They knew exactly which program they were going to go into post-residency, and they were grateful to have a place that had granite countertops and a dishwasher, because they wanted to have those things, and they also wanted to live, as it turned out, 5 blocks from the hospital,
right.
which was really convenient. And so, yeah, there was just this misconception, and I remember a friend of mine putting some of the first rental high-end good touches, good finishes, good space inventory into this stock, and people saying he was crazy. And he's never had a vacancy. He's mm-hmm. always pulled high rental income from those units. And people would say, there's no market for that. No, there's no supply for that, for you to judge if there's a market
exactly
for that.
Right.
And
that's
now that
exactly.
you could see the supply, you could see the demand and start to gauge the market. And so we are seeing historic investments of market rate housing, historic investments of multifamily, higher end market rate housing, both in Auburn and Lewiston, as well as planned neighborhoods that are starting to. So, and it's the neighborhoods, and I know that it's the trails in the neighborhoods, it's the shared green space, and I have kids. I wanted them to ride a bike with their friends too. So, anyway, it's just really nice to hear.
You talk about planned neighborhoods, and
yeah.
you know, the more that we're seeing private equity investment mm-hmm. in healthcare in America, private equity is looking at those planned neighborhoods to ensure that there is housing
yeah.
and communities that is going to be attractive to the talent that they need to attract
yeah.
for
yeah.
Providing healthcare. So, yeah.
Love that. We already talked a little bit about rural healthcare, and I know that you're seeing that. Talk a little bit about the recruiting and retaining healthcare professionals. We named a little bit now, but how does that look different in a more rural than here community? Because you operate in a lot of rural, you're really seeing the rural needs.
So the healthcare recruitment is a really interesting and very complex situation, because when we're talking about how healthcare is paid for, it factors in to the geographic location of where you're recruiting healthcare. There is a factor built into Medicaid and Medicare reimbursement that looks at your geographic region. And it is...
Reimbursement's not the same in New England as it is in the South, as it is on the West Coast?
It's not the same as Portland as it is Lewiston.
Really?
So when the federal government releases its rates every year, there's a distinct difference. And let's just take one patient. You could receive $1,100 for caring for this patient in Lewiston and Auburn, and that's going to be $1,700 in Portland.
Wow.
Because there was an assumption being made in those formulas that say the remuneration, what the compensation is going to be for your employee in Lewiston is less than it's going to be in Portland, is less than it's going to be in Boston, is less than it's going to be in New York. When in fact, I am recruiting and I'm competing not only with the hospitals for the medical staff I hire, for the nursing staff and the therapists and the social workers and all, you know, the multidisciplinary team that I have to hire, I'm competing with the hospitals. And I'm competing. I'm recruiting from Boston.
Yeah.
Those issues of reimbursement play into my ability to recruit the talent here, let's just say in Lewiston and Auburn.
Yeah.
Right. And so it is more of a challenge in rural America, not only because of how healthcare is reimbursed, but then to be able to offer environments and communities that are also attractive.
Yeah.
To those individuals who we want.
My aunt's still on dial-up. She's in Gouldsboro.
Is that by choice or is that...
No, there's not. In the town that I grew up in, Orland, there was some age-old conversation as cable got ran to go through the town, and there was like the town selectmen didn't negotiate, yada, yada, yada. Anyway, the cable company never brought cable to my hometown. To this day, people in the town I grew up in have to use satellite options. They have to create their own individual contract for bringing internet to their community. And so like my aunt has health issues. Shout out to Aunt Beth, who's doing great in general. But like to get her to upload a photo that she can add to Facebook or that she can send to me via a text message.
Or a doctor via telehealth, heaven forbid.
This is my point. Like, I went and visited her and, you know, was doing the, like, customary, like, look, great time with the family and tag the... It was a 20-minute ordeal to do a post. And I was like, I'm done. I'm just going to save these.
Just
and
pick
like,
up the phone and call.
Check in later.
Do they have telephone lines, I hope?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Like,
all right.
That... And it's just an accepted way of life for so many there. But
it's
like for
an economic it creates economic disadvantage.
And disparity, yeah.
And
continued disparity because people of means don't choose to go to that town. Businesses aren't going to start there if you can't swipe a card without hearing the... Right? Like, that's just... Who's doing that? Right? And so it perpetuates the disadvantages that are already there and maintains that in so many ways. And so, yeah, I grew up in a really rural community and I have lived in more populated areas, Orono, Portland, Bangor, you know, Lewiston, Auburn, easily since I was 17. And so it's really easy to forget until I go and spend a good chunk of time just realizing that like, I never have to question the water that comes out of my tap. You know, I don't ever have to wonder if it's time for the septic tank to get cleaned out. I don't have to worry about the trash. Also, we don't have the cool trash and trade sheds that rural communities do have. So, like, there's in the con column. But, like, generally speaking, there are a lot of things that even I, who am very cognizant of it and who grew up and understand, you know, the very distinct advantages and disadvantages of rural communities, that, like, I think there's a... For some of us who grew up that way and left some of those places and go home to visit, I think it's really easy to assume that progress is marching along. And there are many Maine communities. I'm a big fan of rural Maine, so please don't hear it otherwise. But there are many Maine communities where there is progress, like cable got ran, broadband, high-speed internet is there. Like, that is happening, right? We're not all the sticks, right. And we're not all... but there are still very real pockets of Maine that, like, it is 1986 still, mm-hmm. in so many ways. And it's really easy to forget that or to take advantage of that when you have kind of the daily privilege of, like, accessible water that's quality. And you know, not only do I have internet and good internet at home, but, like, everywhere I go does as well. My calls don't drop, you know, some of those basics. But there are lots of folks of who don't have that. And it is a huge disadvantage both for health and business when you don't have that kind of accessibility or reliance on some very basic things.
So I have a workforce that's out in the field.
In all those spaces.
I have to maintain contracts with multiple vendors.
Yeah.
Because I could be linking to a, you know, US cellular tower versus a Verizon versus, you know, you name it, right?
Yeah.
Name them. And it all depends. So I have to have I have to have devices that are compatible and can link to any one of those towers at any given time when I'm in rural Maine trying to, you know, deliver healthcare.
Right. And healthcare. Not an Amazon package.
No.
Not a nope. Right? Like, it's such an important thing. And I, in the same way that I, you know, my siblings were, if they hadn't come and visited me here, I think they wouldn't know what some larger cities are like and what diverse people are like and, you know, cultural options and food options and, like, all of the things that I love, absolutely love about where we call home. But it is easy to also forget that people who have been raised in a community like Lewiston Auburn don't know what it's like to not have access to a bus.
Right.
Not to have that size library, to not have the healthcare options that we have. Like, an urgent care facility was a 40-minute drive. Like, if you couldn't go to the doctors and it was the weekend and you had strep throat, just not even, like, broken bones or an ambulance ride, it's 40 minutes.
Can we really call that urgent care if you're going to drive 40 minutes
no,
or an hour?
No, but that's definitely the name on the door when you get there, and there's nothing in between, right? And so there are so many people who grow up here that, and on the flip side, don't know what it's like to be in those places. And the people are warm, and I've never seen a sense of community caring for each other, right? Whether it's birth, whether it's end of life care, whether it's grieving the way small communities often organized around faith or civic organizations.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's just a tightness there that you can find in pockets here. But so, I mean, it's not one is better or worse than the other, but they're so distinctly different. And I find that it is rare that you meet someone who's familiar with both in a deep way and respectfully respects the differences and doesn't walk in with a judgment or a preference or a bias.
Mm. Mm.
And your staff has to navigate that all the time.
Every day.
Yeah. Thanks for that. Keep up the good work.
I love my team. I was, you know, flying back last night, and I was thinking about, like, what drives me? Because I was, you know, some days it's like, hey, I could trade in my badge and go
I'm gonna
do something
be a professional
different.
Gardener I'll and landscape.
Do something, anything but this today. But when I think about the people who are doing this work out there in the community, and my team that's out there, whether it's driving through a snowstorm to make sure that somebody's getting the medication that they need because they're in pain at end of life, or whether they're driving out to meet a mom whose baby is failing to thrive, and a brand new mom who's just so incredibly frustrated and herself is not feeling well, and everything in between, they are what motivate me.
Yeah.
They are, and they live in those rural communities. They take care of people who in towns that they live and work and play in, right? And so it's they're who inspire me, and they're the ones who also respect the communities.
Yeah.
That rural culture.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I appreciate you calling it a rural culture. I think people just think of it as geography, and it is very much a cultural.
It's a culture.
Yeah, yeah. All right. We're going to move into looking back, leading forward. I crafted a special question for you.
Okay.
So our final segment, You want to do it, sir, with your big, sure, with your, yes, big radio voice?
Looking back, leading... Looking back, leading forward, where we invite our guests to share advice or insights from their experiences to help lead us forward.
So you've navigated high-pressure environments, from emergency rooms to government agencies, D.C., to leading a national healthcare organization. Looking back, what leadership lesson or experience has most shaped your approach, and what advice would you give to emerging healthcare leaders? I've seen some of the strongest leadership from you and your peers. There's a handful of healthcare leaders that I've seen really display strong leadership, and so that can't end when you guys do move to eternal perennial gardening and don't stay in the office anymore. So what advice would you give for them to be successful?
I believe that there has to be alignment and understanding, starting with understanding your own personal values, who you are, what motivates you, and ensuring that, or striving for, your professional experiences, that there is alignment between your personal values, your why, and what you choose to invest yourself in professionally. Mm-hmm. At all stages of my career, whether as a registered nurse running around an emergency department, when I worked at retail and at Sears, and I was I chose that employer for a reason. It was, but I've learned over time, when there isn't alignment, especially as an executive leader, when there's not that alignment that exists, you cannot give your best self.
Yeah.
You cannot bring your best self to work. You cannot be there for the people that need you, the teams of people. Mm-hmm. And you're just unable to invest. But when there is alignment, mm-hmm, when you're making good choices about where to invest yourself, who deserves my talent?
Yeah.
Who deserves what I want to invest and give? And I say that with all respect, no arrogance there, and understanding that we have missions in our lives, mm-hmm, and in our own goals. And the magic in leadership manifests itself when that alignment is true.
Yeah. You can feel it.
You can feel it.
When you're talking to somebody, whether you work for them or you're... Because in my space, not only am I really fortunate to have that well represented on my team here, and I'm fortunate, I feel like I'm very fortunate to be able to live that in this job, in this role, in this moment in my life. And I haven't always had that, right? And so once you find that, I think of it as a calling, like my why really lines up with my ability to live into that in how I spend my days. And it's not every minute of every day that reviewing contracts doesn't get my juices flowing.
Come on.
I love paperwork. but the reality is the ability to spend my days being a champion for Androscoggin County and its communities, and being able to come home and talk to my kids about why I do that, why that means why we live here, and why that means why I show up and rebel rouse at PTA meetings. And right? Because you care. Because
you
care.
But when you first came into this community.
Yeah.
And first, let's just say, came into this role.
Mm-hmm.
You were stretching.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You didn't walk into this knowing.
Oh,
I mean, there was alignment. You could feel like there was this alignment that was of mission and purpose. And
I believed alignment was possible.
Right.
And there was a lot, the questions that you asked, which I think some people do hear that and think that it comes with a sense of arrogance. And I say that because I have said those things and know that that is how they can be received. But even as I interviewed for this job, from the very beginning to the end, it was a 3.5 month process.
Right.
I had my own business, told nobody that I was interviewing for this role. My closest friend and my partner didn't know until I was in the last 2 weeks of the home stretch. And honestly, the first 2.5 months, I participated in interviewing because I felt like it was part of my calling to give my input on what this institution and its impact could be, what its future could look like. Mm-hmm. And it was that process that convinced me that, oh, I might be part of that future and there might be space for me if it aligned with what I believe the opportunity is. But I really started interviewing in this process because I thought it was important for the folks who held the power of the process of the hiring and of the decision making to hear some feedback.
But you took, in accepting this role, you took risk.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's the other part of being able to grow in leadership, is knowing what is good risk and what
healthy
is
risk.
Healthy risk.
Yeah.
And being willing to stretch yourself and to think about what could be, who I can be as a human being, what potential do I want to untap? What potential is this leadership opportunity going to allow me to release, to realize who I can become, knowing that I can, at every step of that way, hopefully I can bring some value to that process, right? And that, and so I think that is just being fearless about the pursuit of goals and the pursuit of what can be.
Oh, I love that. That's great advice. I hope everybody wrote that down. If not, rewind this and write it down right now. Thank you so much for spending some time with me today.
Thank you for having me. Really, it was a lot of fun.
I love our conversations, and then we got to share one of them with others, because I keep pushing and transforming. Keep it up.
You know I don't say no to you, so.
Good. I will personally call you and be like, go disrupt this one.
Yeah.
Go disrupt this one and make some magic happen. Anything from you, Mark?
I just wanted to know, Ken, at what point during your career did you decide that leadership was going to be a significant role for you?
Great question.
I whether it was my youth group in high school, I was... You know, leadership was something I wanted to go after. You know, as president of the youth group, I was, you know, involved. I think leadership, my dad was in the military. I saw leadership, you know, all around me at a very young age. Not always good leadership around me. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, fortunate that the doors, you know, opened for me and I was willing to stretch and take those risks, right? So I think from a very early age, actually, leadership was came natural to me in non-professional environments, and then that translated later on to professional roles.
So you were president of your youth group too.
Mm-hmm. Should we have that?
Were you in Boy Scouts as well? Because I was also in Girl Scouts.
I wasn't in Boy Scouts.
I'll forgive you that.
We moved too much. I moved 23 times by the time I hit high school.
Wow. What branch did your dad serve in?
It wasn't even military necessarily.
Really.
No, my dad was Army, transferred Air Force for some special work, and then transferred back to Army.
Wow.
But Maine was always home. But, even when he wasn't active duty, we moved a lot.
Yeah.
For work and for,
all the stuff.
Right. So, no, Boy Scouts wasn't...
It's not too late.
It's not too late. Definitely have my son involved in Boy Scouts. That was a lot of fun. In this community, in Lewiston. Lots of good lessons learned there for sure.
I love that. I was like 12, 14, that age.
It surprises me about you.
Does it?
No.
I also got the Silver Award in Girl Scouts and a lifetime member of the Girl Scouting Women. In case you wanted another like dorky checkbox to be like, that makes sense. You're welcome.
Again, not a surprise.
Yeah. I love that that was your answer. I love that question, too. Because I think a lot of people, I think choosing leadership early, seeing leadership, I think so many people don't see, discern, understand leadership. They might see hierarchy. They might see power. Right? Like, and I think oftentimes that's conflated with leadership. And I've seen excellent leaders not in title holding, kind of power wielding roles. And I've seen horrible leaders in title holding, power wielding roles. For me, like, leadership is so much about qualities and choices and stretching and risk and believing in opportunity and pursuing it the best in people, the best in the spaces around you. And it was also something that I knew really early.
I also think it's, I was thinking of a, just sitting here thinking of a conversation. I worked for Nicholson and Ryan Jewelers when I was also in high school. It was a jewelry store in Augusta. It was owned by Bennett Katz, and he was a senator. And he asked me one day what I was going to, what I wanted to do. And I think that conversation, and, you know, he was a senator, you know, right? And you know, I'm engraving plates and, you know, for, in, yeah. I'm in high school. But other people who saw something in me that took time to have the conversation with me and let me, gave me the courage to believe that I could be a leader, I think also, or be something and perhaps a leader, is also informative and instructive for how leaders need to return that.
Yes.
So when we see somebody in our community, when we see somebody in our workplace who's just, you know, who's got potential, whether they see it or not, you know, just taking the time to have the conversation can plant seeds that we will never know if they germinate, but it can be meaningful.
Did you ever have the good fortune of meeting Estelle Rubenstein, either of you?
No.
She was the executive director of the Head Start program for like 30 years. I mean, a very long time. And I was a Head Start parent. And I answered the question, someday I'd like to be governor, when Governor Baldacci asked me that question on a shared flight to Washington when I was like 8. Right? So very similar. And so, I mean, I knew that very early about myself. I lost touch with that for many years. Mm. Many kind of like my late college years, birthing, parenting early, or like, you know, you just invest in these other things, and then, you know, I'm working in a restaurant 5 nights a week, and like the notion of what I envisioned my life to be when I was 8 and answered that question, and the fact that, which is funny, as almost 45, but like I was old at 25, right? So like all of those things when I was 25 and somebody would ask me that question, I'm sure I would not have answered the same way. And Estelle Rubenstein saw that in me, invited me onto the board, had those conversations with me, and I guarantee you I wouldn't be here if somebody hadn't paused and said, like, have you ever thought about, maybe I see something that I'd love for, do you see it? That conversation and paying it forward is so important.
It matters.
Yeah.
It matters, paying it forward.
It's the least you can do, right?
Yeah.
I know.
So much.
Thank you.
Yeah.